Dad of you?
Dr. Bilderman? I talked to Mr. Hagler, Palmer Hagler, and I extended him his brother's best wishes. He's from Northern Ireland presently, as some of you may know. Anyway, the conference we did have briefly with the minister's administration and some of the staff in England turned out very well. I would like to preface the background to help you understand a little bit of what can occur. In a sense, we went over there having in mind what we assumed, that the problem is not fundamentally a question of an explanation of doctrine, but rather an analysis of attitude, for the simple reason that a number of individuals over there for several years had been warning headquarters of what was taking place right here in terms of some who used to be among us in the West at the highest levels in administration. And because it wasn't heeded, and it wasn't in time, and there was plenty of warning, but sometimes we're so close to people who become problems that we don't see the problem, and we're not always as realistic as we might be. And part of the reason, therefore, for our trip was to resolve the problem that was still, I think, in the minds of a number, and that is, if we didn't understand and sometimes didn't take action in time over the last year to 2 years, then what is the spiritual state of those who are here? Well, happily, I think we addressed the problem of the spiritual state of affairs in its proper way so that doctrine was seen in perspective. Because after all, if the decision rendered at the May conference with respect to our new grasp and understanding of marriage and divorce is correct, then it is correct because Christ leads the church and he leads it here. Because this is headquarters. And necessarily, what we really had to do was to let them know what Christ was doing in the work and what the understanding and purpose of those who are here is. And when we have that grasp and approach, then we need not be concerned about their understanding of doctrine. Because if they have respect and recognition of the responsibility of those who are here, and this includes Mr. Herbert Armstrong and Mr. Ted Armstrong, it includes certainly Dr. Zimmerman, Mr. Berg, Mr. Kikoch, and others in whom I think most of them had confidence, and this does not mean those I don't name they didn't have confidence in, but sometimes they can get so close to the problems that they don't realize that there are people here who have never been a part of that kind of problem. And with the assurance of the men who went over to England, I was certainly pleased to see that they came to recognize indeed that we all come to know that Christ is head of the church, and if there are mistakes that are made, we must correct them, and that as long as Christ uses the church and guides it, that we can be sure of that guidance and we don't have to have the doubt. So the doubts essentially evaporated. And once the doubt about the responsibility of headquarters evaporated, then the subject, the doctrine of divorce and understanding of marriage, became clear quite quickly. I had the chance to help explain Mr. Cole, Dr. Kuhn, Mr. Hunting, sometimes spoke on behalf of the group there to make everybody welcome, to explain the basic understanding that we have come to not only during the May conference, but since. I had a chance also to speak to the Bible study, the Brick at Wood congregation Friday evening and Sabbath morning, and Dr. Kuhn and Mr. Cole spoke in the afternoon. And then I addressed the congregation in London North Church, where quite a number of brethren are from the Caribbean area. Our black brethren there, who sometimes, being British citizens, find it opportune financially to reside for some time in England. If any of you know of them, I certainly would extend their best wishes to all of you. And for some of you who know, I'll certainly extend the best wishes of my former secretary, Yolette Merritt, who is studying at the University of London. Most of you may not know if you haven't met her. She is a black girl from New York. Most of you do know who are blacks in the congregation here. I spent a few minutes with another man at the place where she resides, where there is an older family staying, though she, at that time when we first arrived, had already gone to London for her classes. And then I saw her Friday evening, and I'm very glad that she was able to do what she has been thus far accomplishing. Today, then, what we should do is take a look at the questions before us that we might have in our minds, to bear in mind also that these questions may not be fundamental when we see the overall picture. In fact, many of the queries that the ministry asked in the various sessions during the May conference were not fundamental to the issue and were not even relevant when we came to see the total picture. I would like to go back and explain what it is we came to see and why in early years of the church, and how we grow in understanding in all subjects, including this particular one. But before I do, I want to mention what I did again last night in the study for some few who may not have been there. And that is, there is, of course, a very grave tendency in the church among some to take upon themselves the responsibility of making decisions in terms of whether a marriage is bound or not, and in so doing, sometimes breaking up a union that God himself does not allow to be broken up by any basis of Scripture. And this, of course, is usually the result of carnality, usually the result of, in fact, the attitude or spirit of adultery. Now, when the question originally arose, Mr. Armstrong, of course, was concerned about a general understanding of marriage in the 1930s when weddings came to be performed. But the real critical issue arose in the late 1930s, when the sister of one of those who has been in the ministry for some years now, at that time, was thinking of marrying a man who was not in the church and a divorcee at that. And this precipitated the original booklet which Mr. Armstrong wrote. Now, what he was really writing to, if you understand the story, he was writing, if you please, to the church about what marriage is. Now, there has been no question either then or now as to what marriage is, what God intended it to be. And I should not have to redefine that. The question that was never really faced at the time was rather not a doctrinal but an administrative question, and that is in fact what was rendered in May. What was rendered in May was in fact not a doctrinal issue at all, but it was an administrative issue. That is, how does one administrate the issues involved in marriage when controversies regarding a marriage contract arise? Now, we should understand what marriage is. You don't, Mr. Armstrong's booklet on why marriage, I think, should clarify that. There are more things that we can always add as we study. But the question is its administration. And when we see it in this light, I think that many of the problems suddenly take on a new perspective. Because in those earlier days, 30 years ago or less, we saw the doctrine clearly in terms of what God intended marriage to be. We then took for granted something, seeing that what God intended marriage to be was not what marriage was often like under the Old Covenant. We assumed that how it was under the Old Covenant relationship with the carnal Israel
must not be how it should be among us. Now, before I clarify that, lest you misunderstand, you all do recognize that there are differences in administration. There was an administration of death, there was the presence of divorce, there was the bill of divorcement, there was slavery, indeed there was war, there was any number of aspects of society in the Old Testament period that differ from our own, certainly around us and in the church. But at that time, we saw that so many of these things seemed to be different from what Jesus himself wanted. Now, what we then assumed was that what Jesus wanted is the way we should administer it and apply it to all people, all times. And we did not realize at that time that what Jesus intends marriage to be, that it was at the beginning when God instituted it in the Garden of Eden before man sinned, that is what God wants your marriage to be or become. And we assumed that that is how we should administer all our past relationships when many or most of you were unconverted before marriage. So the issue, brethren, is not then doctrine. The issue was and is administration. How does one administer the questions that might arise in terms of marriages entered into prior to conversion, or problems or questions that might rise when such problems do occur in marriages after conversion? It's an administrative matter. Marriage is intended to be for life. And I know, of course, that there are many who have various interpretations, some of whom left, some of whom are among us. When the doctrine was being examined, I think that there were tendencies, as with any doctrine, at such a time, to run away from some verses that seemed to support what we have always understood. This happened in Pentecost, it can happen in anything. If we tend to shy away from what could be indeed an answer that was correct all along, let's read what is correct, and let's correct what is an error. Let's not lay aside what doesn't have to be laid aside. And so I'll turn plainly to Romans 7, which I think makes very plain what marriage is intended to be. And there should be no argument over this. But if we see it in its light and with the light of other scriptures, there was the need of doctrinal examination and the need of administrative change. Know you not, brethren? Now he's not talking to non-brethren, he's talking to brethren. Romans 7. Know you not, brethren, for I speak to those that know the law. He's addressing brethren. Now, there were some who might not really have been brethren at Rome, and he's assuming that the brethren are those who know the law. Now, whether you know the law of the land, at least you ought to know the law of God. But the law has dominion over a man as long as he lives. If there is a requirement of law that you've entered into that governs your relationship, as long as you're alive, the law regulates that. So the woman that has a husband is bound by the law to her husband so long as he lives. And if the husband be dead, then she is loosed from the law of her husband. Now, that's a fundamental principle. If a woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband, this is as long as he or she lives. But if the husband be dead, then the law no longer requires her to live with such. So that if while a husband lives, she be married to another, she shall be called an adulteress. Now, there are some people who, having heard the decision in me, decided to leave their husbands because they didn't understand the decision, misunderstood the doctrine, and exercised authority on their own instead of letting the ministry explain it properly. And they did get involved in this very thing condemned in verse 3. So if the husband be dead, she's free from the law. She's no more an adulteress if she'd be married to another man.
Well, what we need to come to understand is, brethren, that marriage, as God had ordained it in the beginning, is what Christ wants it to be, and that's what we want to have
among ourselves if we come voluntarily under the government of God and under God's law.
As long as you are willing to submit to the government of God, as long as Christ is your head, the head of this church, and as long as you seek the kingdom of God, you are in the position of a person who, if you are bound by the law to a mate, you are bound by that person till death. So, there is no difference here in Romans 7 or 1 Corinthians 7. But when it comes to the administration of the matter, we shall see what the rest of Scripture says, because this is addressed to brethren, those who have surrendered to the government of God, to the authority of God, to the will of God. And as long as you're under the government of God, that's the law, that's the teaching of marriage, and that hasn't changed. So in 1 Corinthians 7, we read very plainly, in answer to a series of questions, Paul deals with some problems I won't deal with here that pertain to relationships in marriage. But now we'll pick it up at verse 10. To the married I command, yet not I, 1 Corinthians 7:10, but the Lord, and when it's the Lord who commands, this is normally Paul's reference to Jesus Christ. Let not the wife depart from her husband. And that's Christ's teaching in the gospel. And now, so Dr. Zimmerman would understand, I'm addressing you in a different way than I address the ministry in England, because each group has perhaps a different approach. And I'm addressing you as lay men and women in the church, not as ministers who have all kinds of other questions that have come to you.
But the substance will be the same.
So I'm starting here with those positive verses that make very clear that the doctrine of what marriage is, as Mr. Wayne Cole said over there and has said every time, has been strengthened and was not the issue and was not changed. So listen carefully. To the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, let not the wife depart from her husband. But if she departs, if she departs, let her remain unmarried. Let her remain unmarried. That is the statement. Or be reconciled to her husband. And let not the husband put away his wife. Now listen carefully to this. This is addressed to brethren, the congregation of Corinth. The wife is not to depart from her husband. But if she does separate, that's what depart means, let her remain unmarried. Or be reconciled to her husband. Let not the husband put away his wife. That's the fundamental teaching. That's what God intended of Adam and Eve. Now, even in this, you also see a permission where Jesus recognized that in some rare instances, it's probably easier for people to live separate. But since God intended marriage to be for life, that's what he intended it to be, that if you separate, therefore you're not to remarry someone else as long as the mate to whom you are bound is living. That's true. That's the teaching that has not been changed. But we will expound further so we understand. You see, there is a responsibility that is very important when you enter into such a contract. And this contract is binding because there are no exceptions that pertain to you. Now, there are exceptions. Porneia is one, called fornication in the King James Version. But as long as there are no exceptions,
when you enter into this contract and you have accepted one another, you are allowed on occasion, if that's your problem, to separate, but you are not allowed to divorce and remarry so long as your other mate lives. That is the doctrine. That is unaltered because God intends one to live with the person to whom God has bound you, if there be no exceptions that pertain to you and to your contract. Now we will examine the rest of the story. I wanted to be sure we had that clearly in mind. Let us take then Jesus' teaching, and we'll pick it up where Paul is talking about the principle. In the first gospel, chapter 5 of Matthew, I will pick it up here so that you can see Jesus' basic approach in terms of marriage under the terms and conditions of the New Covenant. The Old Covenant was predicated on the Ten Commandments, fundamentally. That is, it was a marriage agreement, the Old Covenant was, which pertained to agreeing to the law of God. The law of God was stated in such a simple term as this. You've heard that it was said by them of old time. Verse 27, thou shalt not commit adultery. So under the terms of the Old Covenant, you were forbidden to commit adultery. Now, before we go any further, let me explain very clearly. One of the Ten Commandments says, you shall not commit adultery. Now, adultery in the Hebrew, in the Greek, and in the English may be summarized simply as to break an agreement pertaining to marriage. That's what it refers to. All the commandment says is that you shall not violate the terms of the agreement pertaining to marriage. That's all it says. The Ten Commandments do not define the marriage contract. There is nothing in the Ten Commandments telling you what constitutes the marriage. You are only told that whatever does constitute the marriage, you are not to violate the contract that regulates it. But it does not define the regulation of it. It only tells you that you're not to violate it. And some people then have read all kinds of things into that commandment that isn't there, but aren't there. It does not tell you even what Romans 7 or 1 Corinthians 7 did. There's no statement in the Ten Commandments telling you that marriage is for life. There is no statement defining marriage in the Ten Commandments. You have to go elsewhere. What is defined is that you are not to break the agreement. You shall not commit a violation of that marriage contract. That's all that is said. And we need to get that in mind because so often our problem arises by reading things into the scriptures that would not be there. Let us now look further to what Jesus said. That's what you've heard it said. But I say unto you, whosoever looks on a woman to lust after her that hasn't either touched her or had sexual relations with her, that person himself has committed adultery with her already in his heart or mind. So Jesus here analyzes adultery. He's not defining marriage. He's analyzing adultery in terms of its ultimate intent. Not merely an act, but its intent. Now in this connection, therefore, he says, if your right eye offends you, pluck it out, cast it from you. It's profitable for you that one of your members should perish, that not the whole body should be cast into Gehenna. If your right hand offends you, cut it off, cast it from you, for it's profitable for you that one of your members should perish and not your whole body be cast into Gehenna. Now, at this point, Jesus here is taking the proverbial custom, you know, that was in the Middle East, that the thief had his hand cut off, or an adulterer had his eye plucked out. And I have mentioned it wasn't very long ago that an Arab saw a sack of gold in the capital of Saudi Arabia in one of the streets, probably in front of a public building. and he looked into the sack, found it was gold, and reported it to officials. And the officials found that after that he had looked into the sack, and for even having done that, they cut his hand off. Now, over here, they'd let you get by, you know, with a few years for stealing. But over there, that's what they did for a man who didn't even take it. That even to look into what wasn't his, they dealt with him that way, see? Those are interesting people now that do that. It's not quite the Anglo-Saxon approach. But anyway, Jesus is taking that example in the world around him and pointing up that if your problem is adultery, that you can't keep your eye off of some other woman or your hand off of her, then it's better for you, figuratively in this case, to remove the part of your body that causes it than to end in Gehenna fire for even doing something like this that doesn't even lead to the actual act of adultery, but is only in terms of your own thinking. Now, the way to solve the problem is to ask God for his spirit to enable you to keep the law so that the woman, or the, in this case addressing men, so that the woman you're married to looks more beautiful and is more lovely than any woman in the world. That's what marriage is intended to make of two people. Jesus now goes on. It has been said, whoever shall put away his wife, Deuteronomy 24, let him give her a writing of divorcement. Now, the command was not to put away your wife. The command was to write a bill of divorcement. Jesus said, you've heard this. So, according to the old covenant, divorce was taken for granted as a practice. It was not commanded, it was just one of the things that were being practiced. What Moses commanded is this, that if there is a divorce, you have to make it official by issuing a written statement to that effect, defining in writing, Deuteronomy 24, that the divorce has occurred. The law does not command the divorce. It says if or when. The law does command something. It commands that a written statement of the divorce be made. Again, in the Arab world, the man says four times, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you. And if he stops there, she's not divorced. If he said it once more, I divorce you, that's it. And there's nothing she can do about it. Moses does not allow this kind of thing. Moses said a writing of divorcement is required for the protection of the children that may be involved, for the protection of the woman and her property rights who's put away, and for the protection legally also of the man asking for the divorce, or vice versa, a woman if that's the case. The law in Deuteronomy 24 regulated divorce in the manner in which it is issued. That was the command, that it must be in writing. But now Jesus says, whosoever shall put away his wife, instead of just letting divorce be one of the things taken for granted under the old covenant, now Jesus says, let's look at the issue of divorce itself. We're no longer merely regulate it. We're going to look at it as an institution. Whosoever shall put away his wife, except for the cause of porneia, causes her to commit adultery. This is Jesus teaching to the disciples. This is New Testament doctrine. This is the doctrine that we have had for years. This is the doctrine that was re-enunciated in May. There is no change. Whosoever among you, brethren, shall put away his wife, except it be for porneia, causes her to commit adultery, on the assumption she'll get married again or somebody wants to marry her. And whosoever shall marry her that is divorced commits adultery. Now that's very strong, and that's violation in the letter of one of the Ten Commandments. Now there is something here that we overlook. It was an oversight, but in being so close to what God intended marriage to be, Mr. Armstrong and the rest of us came to the conclusion that if that's what God intended marriage to be, then this explanation in verse 32 must pertain to an annulment. This is not the case. Now let me read it clearly. Whosoever shall put away. Put away means to divorce in the Greek. It's the same root word. To sever, to cut off from the contract. Whosoever shall divorce his wife except for the cause of porneia. Now this means that you can then divorce your wife or your husband for the cause of porneia. Now that probably is the biggest change in our understanding, which is an administrative change, actually, that we have. We tried to understand it as if when God has bound the marriage, if God has bound it, then it can never be severed, and if it could be severed by porneia or fornication, then it must not actually be bound, and so we call it an annulment. And we use the English term annulment, which never occurs in the Bible in this sense. The scripture here makes it plain that when a marriage has been bound by God in heaven, let's say, because he was asked to be a party to it, Jesus is addressing the disciple. If God is a part of this marriage, whoever puts this woman away, except the divorce be for the cause of porneia, that's the same as saying, brethren, that a marriage that God has bound can be divorced for this reason. Now, is that clear? That is a fundamental change. At this point, the church was mistaken. And we have corrected it. The exception clause here is an exception that pertains to the one valid reason for church members when both are converted, and as long as you are under the government of God, to be divorced. For the cause of porneia. Now, since most of the problems are not on this issue, and since we have not presented to Mr. Armstrong a final definition from our studies of porneia, I will not define it further except to say the following, but I think I can say the following. The word porneia cannot be used and is not used in Scripture to be the equivalent of a singular act of adultery. There are some who would like to have it, I don't say among us, to be absolutely the equivalent of a singular act of adultery. When there is a mistake that is made, an emotional crisis, let's say, and some woman or some man are involved in adultery, there's a single act, this is not the normal word used to describe it. Porneia would not be an appropriate word to describe that. Now, basically, it does not exclude any of the past definitions the church has given. It may include further definitions, as we might see in examining other verses. But it is not proper at this moment until Mr. Armstrong has evaluated the definitions to go any further, because that's not really fundamental. Jesus even says this is an exception. But it cannot be understood as equivalent, and I think that I can say that very clearly. I know Mr. Armstrong knows that. I know Dr. Zimmerman understands it that way, and all the ministers in England and all of us who went over there understood that that was not the intent of the meaning of that word, that it is a much different word, a different kind of word in its impact. So we learn from this something that we had not learned before, that a marriage, whoever puts away his wife, is involving himself, if you're in the church and you're subject to the law of God and the government of God, you're involving yourself in a violation of one of the Ten Commandments unless there is a cause, which cause is defined in the Greek as porneia, and in this case, certainly has the impact of promiscuity, and this allows for divorce of a marriage that has been bound by God. Because he's not addressing the carnal people, he's addressing the disciples. In other words, what we learn is that if marriage is a contract, then there are terms of the contract which determine when it is binding, and there are terms or definitions in the law that define when it also may be loosed. So a marriage can be bound and a marriage can be loosed, but we have to find out the biblical definitions for it. I think we are far too close to what a marriage should be to see that a marriage can be bound and still loosed by God for this reason. So we had the reason that God didn't bind it in the first place, that's why we could call it an annulment. But that is not a valid way to define it. Let us now turn again to Matthew 19 to understand Jesus' teaching. Because after all, this is important, and Jesus was not saying something that is other than clear to us. What happened is that we didn't see the clear implications of his teaching. Because we were trying to safeguard the teaching of marriage, we read the doctrine into the administration instead of examining the administration after having understood what the doctrine is. Now, Matthew 19, verse 2 again. Here, in this case, a multitude came to Jesus, including Pharisees, with a sticky question. Is it lawful, they said, for a man to put away his wife for every cause? Now, Jesus did not directly answer them. Yes, it is lawful to put away a man, a wife, for every cause, or no, it is not. And then they would have countered with all kinds of arguments, tried to trap him. Now he answered and said unto them, you ought to know the answer. Haven't you read in the scripture that he which made them at the beginning, male and female, said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother, cleave to his wife, and they two shall be one flesh? Wherefore they're no more two, but one flesh. But therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder. And that's where he stops. Now there, Jesus gives the overview in an argument, and you must see and understand this in terms of the fact that Jesus simply shut their mouths by telling them what a marriage ought to be and didn't even answer their question at all. He doesn't even give an exception here. He's saying, well, look, if you understood what marriage was like at the beginning when there was no porneia between Adam and Eve, then you would know, and that's the case he's referring to. He's picking a case in which porneia couldn't even have been involved because they hadn't been living with any other people. There weren't any other people. So he says, look, if you want to know what a marriage is meant to be, go right back to where it started in the Garden of Eden. And this is where Mr. Armstrong started when we presented the presentation at the end of April to him, the May conference. He says what marriage should be, defined here in terms of the original experience, and it isn't they three or they four, it is they twain or two, the old English word, shall become one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder, and we built the doctrine on that as well as on the other verses, but we did not, and it was a mistake. We did not examine the rest of the evidence sufficient in terms of how to administrate or adjudicate such a statement. Now, what therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder, Jesus already said in Matthew 5, has one exception. A divorce can be granted in a marriage that God has joined, if it be to the cause of porneia. So there are exceptional clauses. Exception clauses, I should say. Well, this was a shocker because they didn't really get any answer. They only got what a marriage ought to be. Jesus was focusing their minds on what marriage should be. Well, they said unto him, then how do you explain why Moses commanded to give a writing of divorcement to put her away? Now, what was commanded was not divorce. What was commanded was the writing of a divorcement. To put it in written form, Moses commanded that that be done. Jesus said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, suffered you, or permitted you, to put away your wives. From the beginning, it wasn't so. That's pretty strong talk. All right, Moses gave it permission. Now, how did Moses ever get his permission into the Bible? Well, he got it there because the Yahweh, the Jesus who was speaking here, gave Moses the permission to give the people the permission. Moses did not do this on his own authority because, very plainly and simply stated in Hebrews, Moses was faithful in all his house, in everything he was commanded to do. Moses didn't get this verse put in there on his own, and God didn't see it in time. The Yahweh, the God of the Old Testament, saw to it that this was put in because of the hardness of their hearts. And as we explain in England, the hardness of the human heart suddenly didn't become soft at Pentecost all over the world. Human hearts are the same then and now until God deals with the individual. And so God gave Moses a permission that was not so from the beginning because of human conduct. God does look down and see how weak human beings are. And in this matter, he allowed for the writing of divorcement, a commanded requirement, in cases where people put away their wives when they should not have. In other words, Moses so defined it. Now, we haven't read Moses' definition, but Moses then defined it in broader terms that were intended from the beginning. Now we look further. And I say unto you, now here's the one who gave the permission to Moses to give the permission to the people. But now he's telling them, whosoever shall put away his wife except for porneia. And I would say here we are clearly dealing with the concept of promiscuity and not a single act of adultery. And shall marry another commits adultery, and whoever marries her which is put away commits adultery. But here you note again, whoever shall put away his wife for all these other reasons is involved in adultery, but if it is done for reasons of porneia, this therefore is an exception that God would have permitted from the beginning. It wasn't necessary to define at the beginning because neither Adam and Eve could have been involved in it because there weren't other people around. Here we have, in Matthew 19:9, again a statement, very clear and very direct, that porneia is a reason for divorce or putting away, not for annulment. The concept of annulment is not valid in the biblical sense. It is a term that has been developed in human law, which is irrelevant to the fundamental issues. So here Jesus makes very plain, and he finally did answer their question. And instead of saying, not for every cause, he tells them what they could put away their lives for, and that only. But it can be done. Now, man should not put asunder what God is joining. But when Jesus said that in verse 6, what therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder, he already adds an exception clause in verse 9. That is, what God has joined, man is not to put asunder, except it be for porneia. An exception clause then exists, even in this situation. Now, when his disciples heard that from him, this rather hit them. Well, if the case of a man be so with his wife that he can't put her away for every cause, why, on that basis, knowing what women are like, or at least knowing what those Jewish women were like, and some who have denied themselves for the kingdom of heaven's sake. There are individuals who, in terms of being married to someone, both coming into the church, there may be problems, who would deny themselves if there has to be a separation, deny a remarriage, to live separate instead, like a eunuch, for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He that is able to receive it, let him receive it. And Jesus leaves it up to the individual to do so, and we must be very careful how we handle this problem.
Because Jesus said, who can receive it, let him receive it. And if somebody can't receive it, that's up to the individual, but they have to know where they stand in terms of the kingdom of God and what resurrection they want to come up in. And it doesn't absolutely mean if you miss the first, you're ending in the third. I think Jesus states that very clearly here. He that is able to receive it, let him receive it. But there are those who are married to whom Paul said that they're not to be remarried, but to be reconciled if possible, or if not, at least to be separate. And that's the third category. So Jesus in private recognized, interestingly, before the disciples, that there are people who cannot receive the teaching of the Bible in this connection because they don't have the Spirit of God, in the same way that Jesus recognized it in Moses' day and allowed Moses to give a permission. In Moses' day, it was a public permission in a law for all the people, basically, who were unconverted and carnal. Jesus' statement here is an administrative matter issued in private to the disciples so they would understand how to administrate a matter that what people should aim at in terms of the kingdom of God, in terms of the law as defined and magnified under the new covenant. That is something that he stated publicly, and he gave only the exception of porneia, which allows for divorce. I think this should be very clear, that in private, Jesus shows that there are individuals who are unconverted, of course, and can't all be expected to obey the intent and purpose of the law. Now then, how do we administer it today? The answer is, we must find then, in terms of Jesus' own exception, rather than porneia. Because he would not have had to define this. When he was saying, not all men can receive my saying, he was saying that even in terms of the exception clause. That not everybody can receive it, even with one exception clause. So he is allowing us to see his mind at this time as he did before. How then does God intend marriage to be regulated outside of the jurisdiction of the government of God, where you have contact with Christ, God the Father in heaven, on whom you can call and have the Holy Spirit, the advice of the ministry, and others who are older and experienced, and the encouragement of the brethren? What do you do when you don't have all this going for you? This is what we had to come to in the May conference in terms of the world around us. And now we will take a look at how it was administered. We'll go through the law just broadly. Chapter 21 is a good place to begin with in the book of Exodus. And here we're told about the case of a man who briefly enters into a state of servitude until released. The wife belongs to the master. If his master has given him a wife, and she has borne him sons, in verse 4, and daughters, and the wife and her children shall be his masters. Now, when you look at the commandment, you don't find this. In the commandment, it says, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, your neighbor's wife. A woman is a man's possession. A man is a woman's possession. Most women don't think of it that way, because they don't want to be possessed, maybe it's the reason, by the man. I finally convinced my wife that she possesses me because I know I possess her. Now, here is a law that implies that although the man gives, the master gives the worker a wife, he actually still retains ownership of her. Now, if, of course, he goes out and he lives nearby, I presume he could continue to live with her if they would make such an arrangement. It isn't discussed. In any case, he has to make some arrangement because she and the children belong to the master. and the law didn't even alter this custom. It just assumes the custom, and now it regulates the relationship, because the assumption is that the young man probably does not have the wherewithal to support the woman and her children, and the support in terms of housing, the support in terms of food is more important to her in general than the sexual relationship, and therefore she must remain the master's in order to have the wife and children taken care of, and not to have some man who hasn't saved enough suddenly become responsible and doesn't have another job. That's how God's judgment regulated it. And if the man lived somewhere else in another tribe, then he wouldn't even live with her again. And since she belonged to the master, she was subject to whomever he would give her. That's the way the law was regulated, where you had a certain servitude. This presumes, without any question, that separation, and hence the potentiality of divorce and a remarriage, is built into this system. If the man, verse 7, shall sell his daughter to be a maidservant, and that has happened, of course, in many cultures, she shall not go out as the men servants do if she doesn't please her master who has betrothed her to himself. Then he shall let her be redeemed. To sell her to a strange nation he shall have no power, seeing he has dealt deceitfully with her. Now, the betrothal here is stronger than the term engagement. He has betrothed her to himself, but not yet entered into the second aspect of the Jewish marriage. Now, in this case, Mr. Armstrong mentioned in the booklet that later was withdrawn, that the Jewish custom had a legal betrothal and a later ceremony, and the time in between was a way of guaranteeing whether there would be the possibility of pregnancy. See, that's a way of finding out. Now, this legal betrothal was so binding that it could be set aside only by a divorce. And I want to show you in the New Testament it was the same way. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians. Again, chapter 7. Now, our culture is different. And I want you to know the difference. Our culture does not look on engagement as of legality, but only a social arrangement with no legal force. It might lead to some emotional crisis, as obviously it would if broken down. Now concerning virgins, 25. I have no commandment of the Lord, but I give my judgment as one that has obtained mercy. I suppose, therefore, that it is good for the present distress for a man so to be. Are you bound to a wife? Now, he's talking about virgins. Concerning virgins, seek not to be loosed. Are you loosed from a wife? Seek not a wife. But if you marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marry, speaking of the female, she has not sinned. Nevertheless, such are trouble in the flesh, but I spare you. Now look, here the concept of being loosed and the concept of being bound, see, that's very plain. Are you bound to a wife? Are you loose? Then seek not a wife. But if you have, listen carefully, if you have entered into a betrothal that demanded being loosed by a decree of divorcement, since you had not lived sexually with that person, you're loose. If and when you are loose, if you marry, verse 28, you haven't sinned. So we learn here that if a culture has established a situation where there's a betrothal, that betrothal is binding. But it is only the first step in such a culture where there was a second step that was assumed to be followed immediately by living with one another. The case of Joseph and Mary is an illustration. Before the second step, before they came together, Joseph was betrothed to Mary, and, listen carefully, when he thought about the problem since she was pregnant, he decided to put her away. That means a divorce. Now, we have a different cultural pattern. But I want you to understand that a legal betrothal still involves a divorce, not even an annulment is used. The same terms all the way through, putting away, leasing, these are basic terms that mean the severing of a legal contract. But, and if he take himself another wife, now going back to Exodus, here's a man who has, or he allows the woman to be redeemed, verse 8. To sell her to a strange nation, he is forbidden, seeing he's dealt deceitfully with her, that is, he decided after the betrothal not to accept her. If he has betrothed her to his son, he shall deal with her as if she were his own daughter now. He becomes responsible as a father to a daughter. Now, if he take himself another wife and decides to keep the first woman, then her food, her raiment, and her duty of marriage shall he not diminish. So that he keeps this woman and now is allowed a second wife. And the food, the clothing or shelter, and the duty of marriage, which means nothing other than sexual relationship, and it doesn't mean building a house for her. Some tried to make this mean her food, her clothes, and building a house. I won't comment any further on that. Her duty of marriage. Now, you can build a house for somebody else, and it isn't any duty of marriage. The duty of marriage pertains to sexual responsibility, to fulfill another's needs. That shall not be diminished. So here, the law permitted, legally, polygamy. Do you see how many exceptions there were that didn't even follow the pattern of they two shall be one flesh, as in Genesis chapter 2? And of course, if the first man, or if the man does not fulfill these three, the law says that if you take a second wife, if you don't live sexually with both of them equally and fairly according to their needs, then that woman automatically becomes free. That's the same as saying that the law permitted polygamy, and in that state, God demanded that the man be responsible sexually for as many wives as he had. Now, is that clear? So you understand how God saw the institution in terms of administering it among carnal people. These were unconverted people. That if you're going to have polygamy, then you have to fulfill the requirements of a marriage contract with each. Now, brethren, according to the true spirit and intent of the law, all of this led to some kind of unhappiness. Thus we learn of the wife who was loved and the wife who was hated. Or any woman who isn't loved as much as she deserves to be would consider that the lack of love by a husband is a form of hate. And that's true. That's why the scripture says that. Now we learn that God permitted these things because it was better to permit them with the hardness of the human heart than to be rigid. Even though spiritually the people were reaping a penalty, why, the woman who had the second wife to contend with couldn't be happy, and the second wife could hardly be proud of the situation. The man who decided he couldn't take care of his wife and children and left, and the boss became responsible and gave her to another, these didn't make people happy. But it was better to administer it this way in a society cut off from God spiritually, with only the law and the letter and the administration of death, the death penalty, rather than the Spirit of God being made known so that we can become converted. God saw fit here to administer these things in this fashion. Now we have to then look at it as God looks at it. If God did not impose any more rigid situation on the people, then we would have to say that we should administer these things in terms of the situation as God himself would have wanted them administered. After all, I have happily not been confronted with the problem in Africa of a man who comes with two or three wives. Though I will tell you this. In the earliest years of the college, I'm not sure if my wife was here at the time, when we had an Ethiopian who always brought his two wives to church. I'm sure Dr. Zimmerman would think that was a scandal in the Church of God. But this was done at headquarters when we hadn't yet sunk into sin. thought you'd appreciate that. But after all, the man came among us. We had no real authority yet over him. I don't think he ever was converted. But it was an experience, I'll tell you, to greet both Mrs. and so-and-so. But you see, God looks at the situation as it is in society. And the Old Covenant didn't correct all those situations. It only regulated it. The Old Covenant didn't institute divorce. Brethren, it didn't institute tithing. It didn't institute the Sabbath. It didn't institute slavery. It only regulated tithing, regulates the Sabbath, regulates slavery, regulates divorce, regulates polygamy. By the very nature, God was not intending to change the human heart. But to have a knowledge of God, God had to reveal that certain things needed to be done in such a society. And so it was important that they at least have the Sabbath. And God made it very easy, told them just rest. And he didn't try to change all these other things, whether it be good or evil. But they regulated them according to the letter of the law. Now I will go on, last few minutes here, to Deuteronomy 22. Just to let you know, and you see the principle. If a man take a wife, verse 13, and there are problems that arise, you even see the possibility here of stoning with stones because she was found to be a whore in her father's house. So in this case, there are plain and simple statements made that a young girl, or a young woman, I should say, who was found to have been playing around as a whore in her father's house, that particular person was stoned. Now, let me make plain that there are differences in administration and differences in conduct. There are many girls in the world who submit to men who are their dates, and it is now rather taken for granted in the world, and it must never be in God's church, that a man is not ultimately satisfied with a date if they've had a delightful time at some social occasion, or perhaps a movie, or a dinner, or a dance, but they must now go somewhere and be involved sexually. Now, such a girl is not playing the whore. She's being a fool. Now, I'll tell you what one is like. And there was such a girl, member of a family where the mother was converted and the father was not, who would slip out at night through the window of her bedroom. I had to deal with this case. To go out and to be a whore or prostitute with fellows at school. There are girls who have sex relations only with one fellow. There are all kinds of exceptions to the law of God that people make. And when there is this kind of thing, to have played the whore in the father's house, that was dealt with very severely. And then it gives other illustrations here. In verse 22, if a man be found lying with a woman married to her husband, there was a direct punishment visited here. They both were to be punished, both the man that lay with the woman and the woman. They should die. Stoning with stones is the usual custom, so we shall put away evil from Israel. If a damsel that is a virgin betrothed to a husband be found in the city, because she cried not, the man, because he has humbled his neighbor's wife, and the girl shall be put to death. Put away evil from you. That was made very plain. Verse 25, if a man find a betrothed damsel in the field, the presumption there is that she is innocent. But if it's in town, in the close proximity, now those towns were very close, and any girl could have been heard. If you know how crowded those little towns are, I've excavated in Ashdod. It was a Philistine town, but they're all built in the same pattern. And some rooms, brethren, were twice as big as the top of this podium here in front of me. you know, just big enough to sleep in. Little places. And so there wouldn't be any question. Houses are crowded right next to one another. In our big cities today, it's like practically being in a country, because we live in palaces by standards of those days. Then if a man, in that case a woman was considered guiltless, if a man find a damsel that is a virgin, which has not been betrothed, and lay hold on her and lie with her, then the man that lay with her shall give to the damsel's father so many shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife, because he has humbled her. And it says here, he may not put her away all his days. Now, the fact that she was not ever to be allowed to be put away all his days, that's if the father of the girl accepted it, that's the same as saying that others then could be put away. That's a recognition of the opposite of the custom. The custom allows for divorce. But here is now a statement that in this case, if a fellow takes advantage of a girl and the father doesn't intervene, the father of the girl, that the fellow therefore later can never put her away apart from her death. Others therefore could be put away is the presumption, and so we find in Deuteronomy 24. When a man has taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favor in his eyes, because he has found some uncleanness in her. Now, here's some uncleanness, or matter of uncleanness, different translation, is basically the same expression as Jesus' statement, except it be for porneia. Except that in the Hebrew, it is a broader expression. It is not as definable as it is in Jesus' statement, porneia. But it includes porneia. But it is a term that is so vague that some Jews said this could be a cause for every reason. This is an excuse, rather, for every reason. And some said, no, it must be some sexual reason. Some said, well, it certainly doesn't exclude during post. And it can go all the way. And I hope that would be a reason on occasion. But happily, the children and I like it. Then let him write her a bill of divorcement, give it into her hand, and send her out of his house. And when she is departed out of his house, she may go and be another man's wife. You see, when we understood the doctrine but not the administration, Mr. Armstrong couldn't understand this verse. He was forced in his mind to find a rigid meaning, the covenant relationship of the New Testament, here, because he saw in his mind, he thought that God couldn't permit sin. Well, brethren, God permits the whole world to lie in sin. God does not institute divorce for any reason. God here is regulating sin. Because the people are sinful, he regulated war. He regulated theft. People were going to steal, so he said, all right, this is the penalty. They're going to divorce. There's nothing you can do about it. People will leave one another. And I don't care if the government in the church or any government, a state government, was absolutely rigid. Let me tell you what happens in a country like Italy. In Italy, where they had no divorce, everybody finally knew that Mussolini had a wife and someone else. That land is full of secondary wives. Because you can't stop it. There is no way unless you kill off everybody who even tries it. Now, that might be a German solution. Maybe that's why it occurs to me. It's certainly not the Italian approach. And it isn't God's approach. God says, all right, that's what people are going to do. Well, he doesn't say, I therefore want you to divorce. He said, if that's what you're going to do in any case, there must be a writing of a bill of divorce. And then she can be another man's wife. This is clear. She can be. The time element is not defined. It just means when or in the process of time. It merely says in verse 1, and it come to pass. It doesn't say up to a certain point. This can happen years afterward. There's no regulation of that. Now, if the later husband, that is the second one, or the latter husband, take her,
dislike her, that means doesn't show her the kind of love
that he should, and he decides to write her a bill of divorcement and gives it into her hand, or if the latter husband die, the former husband would send her away, may not take her back to be his wife,
because, brethren, she really is defiled. So because she should have lived with the first name. And the Bible defines it as a defilement. Spiritually, it is. Spiritually, it is. There isn't a one of us who isn't in some way spiritually defiled by our past sins.
Now the question is, you defile your spiritual life, shall I say, or your conscience by breaking the Sabbath.
You defile it by fearing God's tithe, by swearing, if that's your habit. There are any number of things, and people have defiled their life, let's say,
defiled their bodies too, by being involved sexually. We do not say, we didn't say nay, and we don't say no,
that the spiritual law regulating marriage has been so bent that this was not a defilement.
The permission of polygamy still recognizes that the result of it leads to the hatred of one woman and the love of another. Because you can't live, as any Arab will tell you, with more than one woman and love them all equally. It doesn't work. So we discover that even though divorce is permitted, that kind of thing, in fact, in some way, defiled the person. But after the person was defiled, look, God even says, you can't take that woman back. Here's how God regulates you. Now, we didn't really understand it. Let's admit it. We thought, therefore, she had to be bound to the first man. No. The authority of the land was sufficient in the Old Covenant, and if it was sufficient to Israel, God is no more harsh on the Gentiles than other forms of government regulated that aren't God's form of government. And here, God did not even allow this woman ever to go back to the first mate. Did you see that? After the she was defiled, it was spiritually a defilement because it had broken the intent of marriage. But nevertheless, the law of the land, as God set it up, regulated that marriage. When the law of the land, which was essentially administrative, the law defines this in an administrative term, when the law issues, or the judge, I should say, issues a divorce, that divorce severs the contract. It severs the contract. Now, the only exception is if she had no sex relations with a succeeding man, then she could go back to the first woman. But when they were carnal and unconverted, God even forbade that and said, no, that would just give people the chance to try one woman out and then try another and decide to go back to the first one if you thought you liked her better. And God said, that will never happen. To prevent that from happening, God prohibited this woman from going back. And that is the same as saying a recognition of divorce as being legal among the unconverted is absolutely indicated in the 24th chapter of Deuteronomy. Now, God shows, however, that once people have repented and all the past is forgiven,
after all, God was willing to accept Israel back, but he was of a spiritual mind. And of course, we're not necessarily told that Israel had married another nation like the Jews had, but those things are not important. But I would say spiritually, God wipes away all sin. And if both people are converted, then we're no longer dealing with the letter of the law, we're dealing with the intent. And here we're dealing with how God would spiritually deal with it. If a divorce has taken place and they never got along, and they both become converted, they're not bound. They can go their way because the divorce is valid. It is valid right here. But if, on the other hand, they have both spiritually completely repented, There is no question in my mind, and I think I can speak here for all that I know. If there were unfortunate circumstances with both them apart, relative, friends, money, some tragedy, this is, after all, regulating the letter of the law. But it is called asylum, and therefore there is no reason why they could not go back. So what we're learning, brethren, is that God regulates states of affairs among people who are unconverted in a way that we never understood before. Now, besides giving permission beyond porneia for divorce, there is one other thing we must take note in Deuteronomy 7, verse 3. They were not to contract marriages with Gentile nations that were not of the faith of Israel. Now, in Nehemiah 13, we have such contracts set aside, verses 23 to 31. And in Ezra chapter 10, many verses there. Just remember that the marriage was voidable. Those were marriages entered into in Nehemiah and Ezra's day. Ezra 10, Nehemiah 13. They had to be set aside by divorce because they had been legally entered into. But these marriages were voidable but not void. They were voidable because the law said they should not actually have been contracted. But they were contracted nevertheless. And therefore, divorce had to be utilized to set them aside. The law, therefore, really prohibited marriage with someone who was unconverted. This is why Paul says when people are converted, you should now not do what you read of in the Old Testament example. Put away the unconverted mate. And that's what some of the people did right after me. They said, well, look, our marriage isn't bound. That wasn't so. Their marriage was bound. It was still legal. It hadn't been divorced. Every marriage not legally divorced is bound. And yet some people presumed immediately after May to set it aside because the unconverted mate was, as they thought, not bound by God in heaven. That was false. God enters into some contracts because he asked it. But other contracts, nevertheless, are binding, and God recognizes the legitimacy of that contract because every society has a right to regulate it. And even if there is no contract, and you merely take a wife, and you enter in all sincerity to do so, that is binding on you in terms of your conscience. That law becomes a law unto yourself, because you know what is your obligation. Now, that normally doesn't happen, but that is the basis of the common law marriages in the world. I was really not dwelling on that, but I did bring that up last night. So here, if Ezra and Nehemiah had not set them aside, the marriages would have been bound. But they were legally voidable on religious grounds, not even porneia, per se. All right. Paul says, now, I tell you that if the unconverted leaves, then it's like what happened in Ezra's or Nehemiah's day. But let them do it. But if, on the other hand, they're willing to live at peace with you, then don't put the unconverted away. That is, how do you know that what your unconverted wife may finally become converted? Or your unconverted husband may finally become converted, as I see here sometimes in the audience? You know, it can happen over years' time. But if you put away the unconverted mate, the likelihood of conversion would be zero. I think it's great. So that's the way God intended it to be. I happen to know cases like that here. The point is that Paul now shows that spiritually we should not deal in the letter of the law, but according to the intent and purpose. And it is the intent and purpose that marriages be held together in cases like this where possible. So if they can live at peace, then we no longer administrate it according to the letter of the law, we should administrate it according to the spirit of the law, and to keep marriages together so long as it is possible. But and if 10 years after, or 5 years after, or 10 days after, or 5 days after, your unconverted mate decides to leave you, we're no longer in bondage to that contract. That's Paul's teaching. the time element is not stated. Because in the first place, the law allowed the marriage to be set aside. Because the other person was not of the same faith. Now, the probability of the last 10 years is something wrong with you. That it can happen. But you were not to put away the other person. That's Paul's clear teaching in 1 Corinthians 7. Now, the authority of human government to regulate this is recognized in terms of sanctioning, legalizing the marriage, registering it, issuing a decree. The world should be doing it God's way. The world should be teaching what we teach spiritually, but it doesn't. And since the world is unconverted, God is no more harsh on the Gentile world than he was in ancient Israel. And when we see that he allowed through Moses in Deuteronomy 24, he allowed permission beyond what the spiritual intent was. And yet the contract, the legality of those contracts was valid. If it was set aside, that was valid. If there was a remarriage, that was valid. If judges, if ministers in God's church make these decisions, we're going to be held responsible before God in accordance with his law. If we make a mistake in judging, the people who come to us are absolved from it. It's our responsibility if we make such a decision. The courts of the land that promiscuously grant divorces instead of counseling people and trying to get them together, they're going to be held responsible. If they issue the decree, it is issued. And God will judge the judge. That's the way it has to be. That's the way it was in the Old Testament, and we have anarchy. If people presume to do their own thing, then there's anarchy. And we have to recognize the authority that is vested in the world in regulating these matters, as in regulating all areas of society, just as brethren in the church must recognize that there is a government in God's church under Christ that does administer these things. And if you want to, you're both in the church, you're both in converted, if you think you can get away with divorcing your mate who's in the church, and you're in the church, and go marry somebody else in or out of the church, you're making a mistake. There is government in the church to stop it. Not to stop you, but to stop it from being a moment. We must not let it happen. Because I know there are people who would like to take advantage of the situation instead of counseling and learning to love and appreciate the mate that God has given you. Maybe you should focus in on how wretched you are and forget how wretched he or she is. And that would solve most of the problems now, wouldn't it? Shall we have a closing song? A little late, sorry about that.